It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Oktoberfest celebrations are in full swing, part of the fabric of German heritage we embrace in Wisconsin. A good time to check in with a pair of craft brewers. The trade group, the Brewers Association, reported a 1% nationwide increase in beer volume sales last year as tap rooms, brew pubs started filling back up. Join in on the independent brewing scene, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Isaac Shawaki is here, owner of Octopi Brewing in the Madison suburb of Wanakee. Isaac, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks for inviting. Appreciate it.
And Frank Kazuba is here, Director of Brewing Operations at Earth Rider Brewery in Superior. Frank, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Frank, let's start with you. Earth Rider Brewery releasing a beer for Oktoberfest every year, part of your fabric, your culture there at the brewery. So there are two main styles of beers made around Oktoberfest in German breweries. How do you decide which style to go with, which style to create?
Yeah, so traditionally, the beers being served at Oktoberfest were what's considered a Märzen style, and that's more of an amber-colored, full-bodied, multi-sweet, really delicious beer, but it lacks a little bit of drinkability in some cases. And so what the German breweries or the breweries in Munich started doing was they started making a little bit lighter beer, and they called it a fest beer, and that's the style that we decided that we wanted to make, something a little more drinkability, a little more golden in color, still a very malt-forward beer, something very appropriate for the season, but just a little bit more drinkability than a Märzen.
Ooh, I think I learned new jargon, malt-forward beer.
We definitely have a lot of jargon that we can throw around when brewers are talking.
I would imagine, Isaac, you have some jargon in your back pocket as well. You know, what do you love about Oktoberfest beers?
We love to do everything. Like, Oktoberfest is a very special time because all the fall beers and the stouts and the heavier beers start coming online, which is really, really fun to brew and do. We at Octopi, we're a beverage co-packer. We don't own any brands. We make brews for other people. And right now we're doing about 150 different styles of products every month. So
wow.
There's always something new in the pipeline, which is pretty, pretty interesting.
Right. I mean, as a beverage co-packer, that must, I imagine, give you a really wide view of beer trends and what brewers want to create. Can you explain just a bit about what a co-packer is and your role?
Yeah, for sure. So we are a good mid-sized co-packer. We're the third largest production facility in Wisconsin after Molson Coors and City Brewing. And people come to us with their recipes or their ideas, and we make it for them. We produce it and manufacture it for them from anywhere, from small regional breweries all the way to like large supermarket chains or pretty big multinational beverage companies.
Okay. I'm wondering, Frank, you know, with Oktoberfest beers, how they fit into your overall, I guess, suite of beers, if you will. You know, with Märzen means March in German, but this is it's that style is brewed now year around. How do you want Oktoberfest beers to kind of inform your other beers throughout the year?
Well, we brew a number of different styles every year, but we definitely always have one or two German lagers around.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely really appreciate those beers for their clean, crisp character, sometimes a little more malt forward, sometimes a little more hop forward. And really, to me, like drinking beer seasonally is a really cool thing. Like, there's beers that I want to drink in the winter that I wouldn't touch in the summer because they're too heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa. Like, you know, I don't necessarily want to have a Pilsner in January, or that's not the first thing I'm reaching for. So having this beer that makes a lot of sense for the fall or the spring, but in the spring we do more of a couple different kinds of box, two or three different box that we release in the spring. So having a fest beer in our catalog in the fall makes a lot of sense. And I know a lot of people are looking for that this time of year. So
We're discussing craft brewing in Wisconsin. Frank Kazuba, Isaac Shawaki here. Frank is Director of Brewing Operations at Earth Rider Brewery in Superior. Isaac, owner of Octopi Brewing, a co-packer in Wanakee. You can join in on the craft brewing and where you see your favorite craft brew headed. 800-642-1234. Isaac, you know, Octopi has been your American dream, and you've seen tremendous growth. Now all types of beverages that you're bottling. You know, as you have done that work on beer, though, all over the world, what is it about craft beer in the U.S. that is so close to your heart?
It's amazing the variety of styles. Like craft beer or beer in general is much more diverse than, for example, wine. So the fact that you can do from like a really clean, easy drinking beer, you know, like a lager that's 4.5% all the way to like a 12% stout, it just gives you so much diversity and so much creativity to do different stuff. What's really interesting right now is now the new trend of non-alcoholic beer, which is new to us, like we've been doing now for 3 years. That's something that's really exciting. So we can put something that's non-alcoholic or with reduced alcohol in front of a client. And the goal is to make sure that they don't know that it's non-alcoholic and be it, make it as close as a real thing. So I love the innovation in beer and brewing that's constantly changing and constantly evolving.
You have seen the growth in sales for non-alcoholic beer. I think it was about 30% of your sales last winter. What do you see happening there with that segment?
Definitely growing. Here to stay. It's not a fad or a trend. I believe that people want to drink healthier alternatives. You know, they want to cut down on their alcohol consumption. You know, they want to go out and have fun, but they don't want to drink water, right? They want to drink, let's say, the real stuff or as close as the real thing that to beer. So I do believe that non-alcoholic beer is here to stay and definitely grow as people look for different flavors and healthier alternatives for drinks.
Frank, what are your, what do you think of non-alcoholic beer and its future?
Well, I agree with Isaac. I think that a lot of people are reaching for that, and the technology has made it so that the non-alcoholic beers that are being made today are so much better than the ones 20 years ago, even. And because they're being, you know, made kind of in a craft style instead of just a non-alcoholic light lager, there's all kinds of flavors out there that are, I'm really impressed with the new non-alcoholic beers that I've tried.
And for disclosure, we're reaching you in Portland today. As you look at this year's crop of hops, how do you determine whether a kind of hop is right for your brewery?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there are many, many, I mean, there's, you know, hundreds of kinds of varieties of hops out in the market. And much like wine, I mean, they're an agricultural product, much like grapes for wine, depending on where they're grown, they have a different character to them, whether that's in the Willamette Valley in Oregon or the Yakima Valley in Washington or in Wisconsin, because a number of hops are grown in Wisconsin. And so we have ideas about, you know, what we want our beers to taste like. And much like cooking, you know, you come up with an idea of what you want something to taste like, then you have to figure out what the ingredients have to be to get to the end product. And so for different beers that we make, we're looking for different flavors and aromas to come out of those hops. And we have pretty specific ideas in mind for what those hops need to be, and that's what we're looking for when we're out here assessing the hops this year.
How do they look so far? Are you seeing some things that you appreciate in your crops?
Well, I'm excited to see, but we haven't actually gone out yet. We just flew into Portland last night, and this early this morning we're heading
to
out.
To be determined. So when would you use Wisconsin hops?
It just depends on the flavors that we're looking for, and if there's a particular hop that's being grown that presents the flavors that we need for a beer, that's when we would be using it. Yeah.
Frank Kazuba here leads brewing operations at Earth Rider in Superior. Isaac Shawaki owns Octopi Brewing in Wanakee, making beer for other companies that don't have the facilities or capacity perhaps to do it in the Midwest. Join in on the future of the hundreds of craft brewers here in Wisconsin. What you wonder about, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We take stock of craft brewing in our state. Three Wisconsin brewers are on the list of the top 50 producing U.S. craft brewers ranked by the Brewers Association. They are New Glarus Brewing, Minhas Craft Brewery in Monroe, and Stevens Point Brewery. Join in on the independents. What you see, 800-642-1234. Frank Kazuba is here, leads brewing at Earth Rider in Superior. And Isaac Shawaki owns Octopi Brewing in Wanakee, and they stay with us. Isaac, you know, as you have millions of cases, packaging millions of cases a year, I would imagine you have encountered some supply chain constraints. How has that been? What obstacles have you had?
I would say all of them. As a manufacturer and a supplier in the beer world, we've probably been constrained on almost every single supply at different stages during the pandemic, during the last 3 years. It started with cans. First few years was very hard to get cans.
We remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all over the world. CO2 has been on force majeure for now 2 years. You know, it's very hard to get consistent CO2, and you need CO2 to carbonate the beverages. Raw materials, you know, malt is an agricultural product. Unfortunately, the crop last year was terrible, and we only yielded like about 60% of the like regular yield. So malt was in short supply and I would say in poor quality to other years. So it's been a tough year on supply. You know, all raw materials and packaging materials have increased on average 20 to 25% on price. So I would say for a small manufacturer, medium-sized manufacturer, it's been definitely a challenging year to navigate.
We've also seen some big name brewers in Wisconsin go out of business. Ale Asylum in Madison, you know, was Madison's largest craft brewing company. Milwaukee Brewing Company as well closed in recent months. How would you compare starting your brewery today versus a decade ago?
Incredibly harder. Apart from the price increases, the labor market has been really hard. When we started Octopi, we could find, you know, like our starting wages were about $12 an hour. We only offer, for example, health insurance, right? Because I really wanted to offer health insurance for employees, because that's what we could afford. Now we offer full range of benefits. You know, it's starting salary is about $20 an hour. And that's kind of like what you have to compete right now to be able to get good people to help you kind of like succeed and fulfill your goals. So just on the labor part it's just, you know, definitely more challenging to get good people, more expensive. And also on the raw material side, it's been harder to get production. So I would say tread carefully if you're going to open a brewery right now. It's definitely not for the weak of heart.
Tread carefully. Frank, you know, at Earth Rider, celebrating turning 5 years old this month, what types of challenges has Earth Rider encountered here?
Yeah, similar to what Isaac was saying, you know, cans were definitely a struggle to get for a while there, and that has thankfully come around. So they're much easier to acquire. But again, yeah, carbon dioxide is in short supply for carbonating beer, and it's we're looking at ways of saving even more CO2 in our production process to make sure that we can make it last. Those are definitely two of the challenges. And as Isaac said, the malt crop last year was quite poor in North America and in shorter supply too. So they usually keep a supply stock of malt on hand over the winter, and that was running quite low. So it looks like the malt crop is better this year. The barley crop is better this year in the U.S. So that's encouraging for next year.
Are there any global issues? And I'm thinking about Ukraine here. Has that had any impact on brewers?
I'm sure it will. I know that what I was told is that a number of we get a lot of our malt now from Canada, and a lot of those growers were having to make decisions. The farmers up there making decisions on growing barley for brewing or growing wheat to help with the wheat shortage that was going to be perhaps happening because of the developments in the Ukraine.
Isaac, your thoughts there?
One of the main components to make stainless steel comes from Ukraine. So we saw it when the invasion started. Price for stainless steel went through the roof for a short period of time. Now they've stabilized. But I would say right now, equipment is a big one. I don't know if it's connected to Ukraine, but last year has been very challenging to get electrical components for equipment too. But if you want it to be related to Ukraine, it's, I would say stainless steel will be the number one.
I wonder, with electrical components, what do you do if you need a part or a piece of machinery that, you know, that is either broken or needs to be replaced? It's part of your operation.
That's correct. You scramble and you go online and you try to look for it anywhere you can, including used parts, eBay, manufacturers. Some parts were, you know, you could get them 7 days later. You place your order and they would ship to your facility right away. Now there's some lead times in the 30 to 50 weeks to just get a small part. And without that small part, you can't run like your entire bottling line or canning line. So definitely being a very challenging time. And you have to spend more money to have, you know, just parts sitting on inventory in case you need them.
I'm thinking about the mantra that you have, which is, if you try and you get stuck, try something else. How could that mantra be applied to the craft brewing industry now?
Keep moving forward. Don't give up. There's going to be challenges every single day, and just try to resolve them one by one and just keep going.
Mm. We're looking at the challenges to craft brewing in Wisconsin. Isaac Shawaki there and Frank Kazuba, both in brewing operations. Isaac owning Octopi Brewing in Wanakee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Frank, Earthrider earned a gold medal at the World Beer Cup in May for your North Tower Stout in the oatmeal stout category. What makes oatmeal stouts different from other styles of beer?
Well, there's several different kinds of stouts that are, according to the classification system, you know, one of them being like an Irish dry stout, like more like Guinness or Beamish, which is a drier, a little bit lower alcohol stout. Oatmeal stout is also from England originally, but putting some oats in the grist lends a little bit more of a silky full bodiness to the beer. And these beers are also a little stronger in alcohol than like a Guinness would be. So more like ours is coming in at about 6% alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And just a kind of a slightly roasty, chocolatey, full flavored stout.
I want to ask both of you this. Frank, you first. Is there any beer that has really surprised you in a really positive way that you didn't expect recently?
I actually just had a beer last night that was really surprising to me. Not that surprising, but really blew me away with the flavors that were in it, which is kind of the fun thing about craft beers. There's so many great beers out there right now. It's a great time to be a beer drinker. But just a brewery that I went to in Portland last night had this hoppy red ale that was just wonderful and beyond my expectations of what it could taste like. So it's fun to get surprises of when you try a beer and it exceeds your expectations.
Yes. Any words for the flavors that you experienced in that beer?
Well, it was malty without being too sweet. And
come on, use your jargon, Frank.
it had this dark fruit character from some of the crystal malts they were using in there, and balanced nicely by the hop bitterness was not excessive, but balanced that malt sweetness really nicely. It was just a really, really impressive beer.
Isaac, any beers that have blown you away recently with their flavors?
Yeah, it's a brand we do for. It's called Untitled Art, and their non-alcoholic juicy IPA is incredible. It tastes like the real deal. It's a hazy IPA made with Citra and Mosaic hops. So it's excellent and super drinkable, crushable. It's only like, I think, 60 calories. So it's also low in calories, healthy, and it's just delicious if you want to kind of like get a kick of a good beer without having the alcohol content.
What do you pair it with? What do you like to drink it with?
Anything. Good hazy IPA. You can drink it with a burger, fried chicken, salad. You know, it's endless. Some tacos, some fried fish. Kind of like almost pairs with almost anything.
Very quickly, we're out of time here. What kinds of beverages do you expect will grow in popularity in the coming years? I mean, you've talked about non-alcoholic. Anything else you see?
I'm a true believer that hopefully in the next few years, if marijuana THC gets legalized, we're going to definitely see a rise of THC drinks in the market. And I would say that would be the biggest disruptor for innovation in beverages in the next few years.
We'll be watching. Isaac and Frank, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Isaac Shawaki, owner of Octopi Brewing in Wanakee, Frank Kazuba, director of brewing operations at Earthrider Brewery in Superior. For disclosure, Earthrider is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Up ahead, we delve into the intersection of, get this, history and craft beer with a UW-Milwaukee anthropologist who studies ancient beer and the evolution of the craft beverage movement. Join in 800-642-1234 with your questions. Ancient civilization and beer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, bringing ancient alcohol back to life and why it matters to build bridges between our ancient ancestors and today's modern craft brewers. Join in on fermented drinks, how they evolved, who had access to them in ritual feasts thousands of years ago. 800-642-1234. Bettina Arnold is a professor in the Department of Anthropology at UW-Milwaukee, where her expertise is in the pre-Roman European Iron Age. She studied the archaeology and history of ancient brewing practices, brewed some pre-hops alcohol herself. Bettina, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So sometime between the end of the last ice age and the start of when animals get domesticated, humans start experimenting with fermentation. Why is this moment in evolution important to study?
Well, one of the reasons is that, you know, you could argue that you are what you eat, and cuisine is to a large extent a pretty significant part of how we mark cultural identification. And that includes what we drink, and alcoholic beverages, for a whole range of reasons, they're actually part of a suite of fermented foods that it turns out are often underappreciated by the sort of general public, because they do make things easier to digest, make it easier for our systems to sort of extract nutrients from the foods that we eat and from the drinks that we consume. But alcohol has another really important sort of role to play in human culture, which is that it acts as what's called a social lubricant. And that basically means that it makes interaction easier. And since we're social animals, it's obviously a way to reduce anxiety when we're interacting with each other, but it also marks moments in people's lives. It still does this and obviously always has. And there seems to have been a pretty significant incentive because of the mood altering qualities of alcoholic beverages to produce it pretty early on. And even though the jury is still out about exactly when the earliest alcoholic beverages were produced, somewhere presumably around the time that you've just mentioned, or, you know, shortly after that, it's really less important to focus on where sort of the earliest alcohol is produced and more important to focus on how it was used in those different cultures.
Yes, and who had access to it. That to me would be really interesting from your standpoint anthropologically.
Right, because even in today's world, not everybody gets to drink alcoholic beverages, obviously. Mm-hmm. There are rules and regulations almost always about who drinks it, under what circumstances, in what kinds of contexts, as well as obviously who's involved in producing it. But the fact that it's so often a part of religious ritual, we assume at this point, archaeologically speaking, based on the evidence that has accumulated, that that was also a pretty important element in its production and sort of the driver behind increased sort of resources being put towards the consumption of alcoholic beverages in those kinds of settings, in a ritual setting in particular.
How did you become interested in this research area in ancient alcohol?
Right. So Iron Age Celtic Europe, so about 800 BC to when the Romans crossed the Alps in the first century BC, is a really fascinating period because these folks had no writing. And that means that everything we know about them has come down to us through the archaeological record. We have some written sources later in Ireland, for example, and in Wales, in Celtic-speaking countries that were actually writing some of these sorts of what we call feasting practices and alcohol related types of material culture concepts down. But in the period I'm interested in, and I work in Southwest Germany, it's mostly the burial record that is really important. And that was something I needed to find a way to understand, because so many really high status graves in the period between about 600 and 400 BC, which is my primary focus, contained objects that were clearly primarily intended to be used in feasting activities. And it, not only the containers were present in the burials, but the actual alcoholic beverages were also. And while we had some notion that these populations viewed what happened after you died as a sort of extension of this world, it was obviously important to try to understand the role that was being played then by those alcoholic beverages. And those seem to have been more important than food, in terms of what was given to the dead people to take with them when they sort of crossed over and made this transition. So the idea of a sort of BYOB afterlife was obviously something that, you know, was I found really interesting, but also I needed to try to figure out a way to understand it. And that's where some of the Celtic literature from Wales and Ireland started to kind of appeal to me a bit more as a source of information. And then in 2000, in my excavations in Germany, we actually found a sheet bronze cauldron that contained a mixture, some kind of a honey-based beverage, probably combined with a malt beverage, that had been flavored with some botanicals based on the pollen analysis that was conducted. And I got really intrigued by this and wanted to know what that would taste like. So that's kind of the backstory.
It's fascinating, too, because, you know, the artifacts tell a story in helping you put the pieces together on the lives of these people and what they were doing. But it's a whole nother thing to try to recreate, you know, a beverage that dates back thousands of years. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, it's not really a recreation. We kind of call it a rebrew. And the idea is primarily just to expose people, including ourselves really, to the kind of flavorscapes that would have been available to these populations, because obviously the yeast would have been different. There were no hops at the time. I know your previous guests spent a lot of time talking about hops and how they changed the flavor of beer. I don't know if they talked as much about yeast, but that's a major player. And there's a huge amount we don't know about yeasts in general. It's kind of, there are 1,500 known species, but it's the Wild West still in terms of figuring out how they relate to each other. And there are even people out there called yeast wranglers whose job it is effectively to try to see if you can come up with new strains of yeast that do really odd things to beer, make them taste like they have fruit in them when they don't, for example. So we know that regional styles probably already were emerging at that point because the yeasts are specific to a particular area. So there are a whole sort of range of things that you can get out of this sort of more experimental piece. But that said, you know, even though we know we're not actually able to completely recreate one of these beverages, based on the botanicals that we know were present, based on, to some extent, the ability to determine sort of the water type, I mean, how, you know, what the mineral content is in the water in the region won't have changed much because, again, the geology is still the same. Hmm. So we can sort of account for some variables and try to sort of, you know, make sure that we're as close as we can be there. But the one thing that's definitely the case is that what you end up with is not going to be like anything you could get on a grocery shelf today or in a bar. So, and I think people are often very surprised by, among other things, the fact that without hops and with other kinds of plant additives, they actually quite like beer. Some people that will tell you they don't like beer, often what they're doing is reacting to the bitterness of the hops, and IPAs in particular, I think, tend to turn off those people. They tend to like sours frequently, especially fruity sort of sours. And that comes closer to the kinds of beers that a lot of these early pre-pasteurization, pre-refrigeration beverages would have tasted like.
Mm. Bettina Arnold with us as we explore the intersection of ancient history and beer. She's a professor of anthropology at UW-Milwaukee. Join in with your questions on ancient brews, 800-642-1234. So leapfrogging from this far, far history that gives us a bit more of a foundation, how do you judge what makes an award-winning rebrew today?
That's a good question. So, I mean, award winnings may be going a bit far. There are not a huge number of people that are really doing this. It's referred to as extreme brewing. And one of the earliest sort of attempts at partnerships between sort of the academic side and the brewing side was Patrick McGovern working together with Dogfish Head and Sam Calagione, who at the time was still running that brewery. He's since sort of handed off the reins to others, but they're still interested in those kinds of collaborations, actually, and are possibly even, I'd have to double check this, attempting a rebrew of our Braggot that is based on the excavation that we conducted in Southwest Germany in 2000 that I just mentioned. So, but it basically allows these collaborations between academic institutions like universities and museums and breweries allows those of us interested in this subject to draw in the general public and get them to be maybe more aware of this enormously diverse and rich world, not only of flavorscapes, but of cultures out there. These are often people who maybe were bored with history in high school or uninterested in it, you know, at the college level. And they find that some aspect of this particular topic appeals to them. And so we can effectively use it as a kind of, I would say a gateway drug, that's gonna sound terrible, but in a good way to educate people about science on the one hand, about culture, about history and about archaeology.
Sure, such a gateway there to, as you mentioned, culture and history and society. Well, here's something that, you know, there's this growing academic consensus that women were original brewers in some ancient societies, and they were upper class women. Can you help us with that historical record?
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of issue. And it's obviously inferential. In other words, we can't prove it necessarily. On the one hand, you know, women in pre-Neolithic societies, that is before plant and animal domestication, in many so-called traditional contexts were the ones responsible for gathering plants. And the assumption is that some of these early experiments with brewing might have happened because gathered plants that were stored in a vessel possibly, or some type of a container near a structure, actually were, you know, began sprouting effectively and then were dried and started fermenting spontaneously. And that might've been more likely to have been recognized by women, let's put it that way. Ethnographically, so when you're looking at sort of more recent times, it is true that women are often the brewers in traditional societies, but that doesn't mean they were exclusively the brewers. So we know, for example, that in ancient Egypt, based on these absolutely fabulous scale models of brewing and baking facilities, that both men and women were involved. I mean, that was on an industrial scale already in the Bronze Age, largely because they needed beer as a way to keep their workers going, right? Somebody had to build those pyramids, and beer was one of the things that fueled the people that were building them. So it's a complicated kind of question. And I would hesitate to say that there's a strict gender divide there because it varies so much. On the other hand, there's no doubt that brewsters, there is actually a technical term there in historical context for women brewers. They've always existed. And in some contexts, they definitely were in the majority.
UW-Milwaukee anthropologist Bettina Arnold, as we explore the larger context of the origins of fermented beverages, connecting it to our brewing movement today. Join in with your curiosities about the earliest alcoholic beverages. 800-642-1234. Still time to talk. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore ancient alcoholic beverages and fermenting methods that are practically as old as human civilization itself. Ancient alcoholic drinking traditions that could help us understand how we view beer and wine today. Still time to talk about fermented alcoholic beverages, perhaps Groot, a drink much like beer made without hops, 800-642-1234. Bettina Arnold is an anthropology professor at UW-Milwaukee, stays with us. Bettina, we heard from Grant, sent us an email to say that it appears that the development of brewing and baking happened concurrently as a way of preserving raw materials for consuming later. It's known that brewers and bakers have had a very long-standing relationship. And what can you tell us about that kind of partnership?
Well, the process, of course, is really very similar. And actually, one of the oldest so-called cold-mashed beers produced in ancient Sumer, in what's referred to as Sumeria, in the Bronze Age, was a recipe really making use of a kind of sourdough bread that had been toasted, partially baked, but still containing enough of the yeast to get the sort of brew going without the application of heat. So it's literally the case that the two are, you know, effectively so closely related, baking and brewing, that they're often actually archaeologically found happening side by side. You need water, you need some type of a heat source typically, and the same ingredients are used for both.
What about Groot? You know, European societies using a kind of grain-based alcohol for hundreds of years. What separates that, you know, ancient beverage like Groot from a modern beer made using hops?
Right. Well, effectively, hops are just another kind of plant additive. It's just the one that we happen to be the most familiar with. Mm-hmm. And Groots are effectively unhopped, but also with a variety of different types of plants that can be used that in some ways do the same sort of job that hops does in sort of contemporary contexts. So things like mugwort, not a familiar plant for most people, although it grows wild as a weed in a lot of places in Wisconsin. Meadowsweet is often found when there's honey in the mix somehow. It could be for a straight up mead or something called a braggot. Meadowsweet's often found in these mixes of both beer and mead or honey, so kind of co-fermentation. Something called bog myrtle, which is actually a bush with a very, it's a kind of scent reminiscent to some extent of spruce. And spruce tips are used in Northern Europe, which is also where bog myrtle is found as a bittering agent and a flavoring agent. There's almost, you know, no limit really to what you can use in Gruit. So Gruit is really just a descriptive term for a beer that's brewed without hops, but with some other type of plant additive, or more than one actually in some cases, as a kind of flavoring agent.
Let's bring in Suzanne in Stoughton. Suzanne, what are you wondering?
This is a fascinating conversation, and I just wanted to point out also apples and ciders and what a wonderful way it is to turn produce that would otherwise be going bad into a product that has a long life cycle. And so even here in Stoughton, we are having a cidery festival in October where all these great ciders are coming in, and it's a way that our local community is able to use a lot of their fruit that would otherwise go to waste.
Suzanne, thank you for that. Can you talk, Bettina, about ancient ciders or what the archaeology and anthropology says there?
Yeah, absolutely. No, the use of fruit-based alcoholic beverages also probably is quite ancient. It's just been a bit more difficult to prove its presence. Obviously, the wine vine is a relatively late addition in Northern Europe. It doesn't grow there until after the Roman period. And that includes places like France and Germany, where wines are typically found growing today. But they definitely would have had access to apples and pears and other kinds of fruits. And there's increasing evidence now that they were mixing some of these, you know, kind of fruit juice-based alcoholic beverages with things like honey. And if you do that with apples, you end up with something called a cider. If it's a co-fermentation where you've got honey and apple juice effectively fermenting together, and that can produce something really, really lovely. I mean, totally not like the sort of mead, let's say, that you're typically going to get at a Renaissance fair, which is very cloying and sweet. And the two complement each other beautifully. There's also what's called perry, which is sort of a cider-like beverage, but made with a particular variety of pear. But I like the, you know, the connection that the caller just made about how do you deal with fruit that isn't really necessarily very appealing to eat in at this time of year when you have so much of it. And that would definitely have been one of the sort of sources of vitamin C and storable vitamin C going into the sort of fall months. I mean, without refrigeration, there's obviously a limit to how long you can keep that kind of beverage safely, but the alcohol content plays a big role there. Mm-hmm. And one of my graduate students, one of my PhD students, Josh Driscoll, has discovered that even unhopped, unrefrigerated beers, and in this case, you could include things like ciders, if the alcohol level is high enough and there's no oxygen getting into the container, can be kept for quite a long time.
So certainly a problem today that even mirrors what issues they were having way back then. Bettina Arnold, professor of anthropology, UW-Milwaukee, with us as we talk about ancient beer. You can join in 800-642-1234. Bettina, we heard from Jarek, who sent an email to ask, is hops in beer a modern invention? What proof do we have that no one did it before early modern industrial brewers in Germany started using it as a preservative?
So it's not really modern. It actually comes in terms of the written record, we see it in the monastery records showing up probably in about the 11th century AD. And the archaeological evidence is based primarily on pollen grains. So those preserve quite well. And generally speaking, the assumption is if you don't find them, they're not present. And once they actually do start to show up on a large scale, suggesting that, you know, they're not just wild hops growing sort of locally, but are actively being used in brewing, then you're going to be able to make the statement that they're actually a constituent element in that production process. And that really doesn't seem to happen in prehistory. We just don't have the pollen evidence to suggest it. I'm not ruling out the possibility that they might have been included as an adjunct. And I would say that some of the paleoethnobotanists out there studying this probably would also be cautious about it. The occasional hop grain of pollen has been found in some contexts, but definitely not on a large scale or on a regular basis.
Well, we only have a few moments left, but for hobbyists out there trying to make rebrews of ancient alcohol at home, is that possible? Any tips?
Totally. And if you're interested, there are several places you can look online to get recipes and tips. One of them is a wonderful blog by a guy called Lars Garshol, who's a Scandinavian researcher from Norway, who's been doing a lot of really interesting research into traditional beverages in Norwegian farmhouse ales, for example. But my website also, if you search for my name, you'll be able to find experimental recipes that we've, to some extent, tested, if you want to call it that, so we know they kind of work. And I'm also happy to answer any questions people might have if they want to shoot me an email, if they're in the process of trying to plan something like this. It's not complicated, really. I mean, we're talking about, you know, three basic ingredients. If you have those, you're good to go.
Bettina, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Bettina Arnold is a professor in the Department of Anthropology at UW-Milwaukee. Earlier, we talked with craft brewers Frank Kazuba and Isaac Shawaki. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.